Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, hi there. I'm Joe Krolder with the New Books Network, and we are talking today with Kristen Hussey, who has written a fantastic book called Imperial Bodies in London, Empire Mobility and the Making of British Medicine, 1880 to 1914. Welcome to the New Books Network, Kristen.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited for our conversation.
Me too. First question, who is Kristen Hussey?
Who knows? It's a complicated one because I'm sort of two things. I'm a historian of medicine and science, and I'm a curator, a museum professional. And at different points of my career, I'm doing one or the other thing. And at this particular moment in time, I'm trying to do both simultaneously. So it's sort of a double hat that I wear.
You are living the dream. Oh, my goodness. No, I got my museum credential as well as my history PhD degree. And I'm like, will a museum have me? And the answer has been no, but it's okay.
It's really difficult. And I would say one of the things, if I get asked to speak, you know, to groups the most, it's in my capacity as a museum curator. And it's, I think it's often, history students sort of have an idea that it's one of the careers that you can have as a historian. But actually, you know, to be a museum curator and a museum professional, it's like its own vocation. And while many museum curators are themselves historians, that's often not what is getting you those jobs. So it's a weird sort of relationship.
It certainly is. And, yeah. And it's something for our listeners to think about if you're thinking about going in that direction. but I do want to talk about the history of medicine and what got you interested in that.
Yeah. I mean, through my work in museums, I've had a very, my career wasn't originally aiming towards history or being a historian. And I did my master's degree in museum studies in curatorship. And I got my first job at the Science Museum in London. And my job was to catalog the pharmaceutical and surgical collections of their national medical collection. So it wasn't something I knew a lot about before that point, but then I was just literally immersed in the history of medicine all day, every day. And I became just immediately fascinated by it. And I was reading all of these books, you know, on the train home. And kind of through that more hands-on experience, I ended up working as an assistant curator at a museum called the Hunterian Museum in London, which is part of the Royal College of Surgeons. So it was a real hands-on training in the history of medicine and surgery. And then after a few years of doing that, I was so motivated to really deepen my understanding that I went back to do a PhD in history.
Outstanding. It's just so funny how we get immersed in things and it just piques our interest.
Yeah.
So tell me about the title of the book. How did you come up with the entitle, Imperial Bodies?
You know, it's a funny, this book had, and I'm sure many authors will, you know, feel familiar with this. It's had so many titles, over the years. And this is one that the honest answer is that I was in a pub with some friends complaining about how I couldn't come up with like an exciting enough name for my book. And we like had pieces of paper on the table and I was just writing down all the keywords and we were like trying to like, I don't know, Jenga that into something which felt right. So it was trying to mash together. I mean, I'm really happy with the title, the end, because it really is literally just, it's what's in the book. It's what this book is about. It's about imperial bodies. It's about the city of London. It's about the British Empire. It's about moving, and it's about British medicine, and it's about their relationship to each other. So that's sort of how it all came into being. And actually, Imperial Bodies is the name of a book, a great book that already exists by Elizabeth Collingham. So, in London, is trying to sort of like spice it up and say, okay, you know, we've written about the idea of the history of the body in the empire. What's new in this? What's making it different? It's that kind of metropolitan focus.
Yeah. I when I first saw the title, I was like, and then, you know, halfway through the book, it's like, this totally makes sense. So thank you so much for that answer. This is Joe Crowder, New Books Network. I'm talking with the fabulous Kristen Hussey, extraordinaire. And we're going to be talking about, I guess, the way you broke this down, the liver, the brain, the eyes, the blood. What other parts of the body did you research and then kick out?
You know, there was going to be another chapter called the skin. And I think dermatology is such a, the skin is sort of our borderland, right, between us and the world. Sort of a bit like the eyes, but it's very personal and very sort of unsettling, the idea of things on and in our skin. And it was a chapter that was in the main about leprosy and anxieties around the importation of leprosy and the experience of Europeans getting leprosy abroad and coming back. But in the end, I felt that it's research that's gone into some articles I've done, but leprosy is a very well-trodden subject. So I decided against it in the end, but I'm still fascinated by the skin.
Yeah, and there's absolute relationship between the skin, because that's going to be the first organ that catches all that sun and heat in the tropics, and then transfers that on into other vital organs here.
Yeah.
Brilliant. One of the things that struck me at the beginning was infrastructure, and I think it's an important point in your book. In two ways. One is the physical planet infrastructure. So like digging out that Suez Canal, steamships, bigger, faster, and then the dredging of deep water ports that makes it possible for imperial bodies to get from the empire back to London quickly. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's a really good point, because it would be silly to say that it's a book about movement and mobility without thinking about what it is that makes that mobility possible. And while it's not a book that's a technological history, the idea of infrastructure and technology completely underlies all of what it's about. And really, I think steam power, as you say, is a super crucial part of what's happening, because if were it not for sort of quick enough transportation technology, but also arguably communication technology that's really coming to the fore in this sort of late 19th century period, none of these conversations or exchanges would have been possible. And I was really interested also in the book of the idea of the post. I think it would have been cooler to get even more into that, you know, how not just people, you know, circulated, but insects, you know, being shipped. I talk a bit about, you know, blood samples getting sent in the post, another really important medical infrastructure that I think would be, is still could use more delving into.
Yeah, I think there's one point in the book where you talked about someone shipping mosquitoes in the post from Italy to London. I can't remember who that was. That Manson?
It was. I mean, he was part of the group of researchers, sort of a collaboration of Italian and British researchers that were coordinating that. You know, and it's such a funny logistical problem. How do you get live mosquitoes from, you know, an environment warm enough to support them to England, quick enough for them to survive? So they, you know, originally wanted to get mosquitoes from India, but that was much too great a distance to be practicable. So they settle on Italy and also a little bit in Spain, and then they try it a number of times and it's not working. And in the end, Manson manages to negotiate this like special delivery with the Postmaster General that they're going to throw all their effort to get these mosquitoes from Italy to London in basically 24 hours. And that in itself is like, what an achievement. Yeah.
It's amazing. The FedEx of its times, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, I bring this up because, I went to a school in West England, Bristol, University of Bristol, and it's got this floating harbor. And to go up the Avon, you got all these locks to raise the ships up to get to that harbor. But at some point, the ships just became too big. And so what Bristol is really, the port, is like this 18th century, maybe early 19th century still. Okay, we can handle wooden ships, but you know, you go to London, and you realize how brilliant London is for handling steam.
I lived in London for many years, and that's where I did my PhD. And I think sometimes people forget some of the inner docks, you know, somewhere like St. Catherine's Docks, that they ever were really docklands, because it's been such a long time since they were used in that way. Whereas the deep docks out, you know, St. Albert's Dock, they really feel, they still very much have that kind of industrial feeling to them. And they are an important part of the city, but they're also just that little bit, it's almost the fact that they're a little bit far, that extra, as you say, logistical challenge that makes them kind of an exciting and interesting place, because they're both a challenge to get people there, whether it's people who are working there, people who want to go and arrive there, you know, and goods from that area. And the reason why, you know, I talk a lot in the book about the Albert Dock Hospital as a particular site of medicine, which was made for the deep docks, because if you had a sailor coming off of one of those steamships with a broken leg or a serious injury, there's no way they were going to make it to Greenwich in time. It's simply too far. It's sort of hard, you know, the mind boggles at the large size of the London docks in this period. And just sort of because it happens to be there, it's this accident injury place that Patrick Manson's like, I think I can make a better use of this, that tropical medicine comes to be what it is. So the infrastructure is always there beneath it.
And it's a good segue to talk about the other infrastructure that I found fascinating in this book, and that's the printing of trade journals and magazines, the kind of the hierarchy of medical knowledge being passed around London at the time. And can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, the print media is a really large part of this book, whether it's advertisements. I talk a lot about advertising in newspapers across the country, but also the many, many different local newspapers within London. Newspaper reports, I talk about autopsy reports, court reports, and then also the sort of specific medical and surgical trade journals. It's when I think about the print culture in the 19th century, I mean, I think about it in terms of sort of the internet age, almost in a sense, in terms of how much information there is there, how much there is to read, and kind of the fascination people have with keeping up with the news and how much information there is coming out, you know, from within the city and around the world. So it's both an exciting material to work with as a historian, but also quite overwhelming. And I think something that increasingly historians now are arguing that when we work with, you know, 19th century print media, we have to be more cautious, I think, in trying to understand what the different like purposes of all of those journals were. You know, who is editing them? Who are they written for? What are the different communities who were reading them? Because I think it's quite easy to misinterpret maybe what's in there if you're not really thinking about what communities are aligned with different journals. And it's something I try and do with the Indian Medical Gazette, for example, is to not just present stuff that I'm reading in it, but really think about the context of who's reading it and writing it, and what does that mean within the medical community. You know, how are those discussions perceived because of who's associated with a particular branch of print media.
I absolutely love the fact that you related this to the modern internet as far as so much information, because there's also quite a bit of misinformation too.
Yeah.
And you talk a lot about quack medicines at the time and flooding the market with all these weird homeopathic sort of things. Mm. Care to talk about that?
Yeah. I wish I could remember it now. I think I give a statistic, like an exact statistic in the book, of what percentage of like newspapers' revenue comes from patent medicine advertisements. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was an enormous amount. And some scholars have argued that the newspaper industry was propped up by the sale of patent medicines. It was so ubiquitous in the period. And if you work at all with Victorian newspapers, you know, it's overwhelming the amount of pages that are taken up by the selling of very various rate. I talk in the book about there's a big commission in the turn of the 20, you know, early years of the 20th century to try and counteract the patent medicine trade. And they take to the lab, right, samples of what is in all of these kind of mysterious medicines. Are they actually doing anything that they claim to? And they find that for the most part, they're just laxatives. in the main, you know, I mean, some of them contain really bad and dangerous things, but actually many of them were like sugar and water and rhubarb laxatives, which, you know, maybe that, I think it's a time where there's a lot of digestive disease. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking some laxatives if you need them, but it was probably not going to cure cancer or consumption or whatever else.
Or yeah. I have COVID, let me take some horse dewormer. You know, I guess what I'm getting at is there's such a parallel to today.
I guess for me a bit also, like today I feel a very strong empathy for people in these situations, you know. And I think part of what I'm trying to do in the section where I talk the most about patent medicines, about tropical returners who are kind of struggling with, you know, chronic dysentery, that are taking, you know, whatever they are being told in the newspapers is going to save them. You know, it's a time where a lot of people don't have access to the kind of healthcare we have now. And I really sort of feel for being in a position like that. And I mean, it's, you know, and that for me, that's where the difference is, I think, because, not that I know that much about horse medicine, today I think people have a lot more access and knowledge about medicine and medical care, and are making choices to do things like that. Whereas I think it's not quite the same for 19th century people.
You're being very kind. I'm talking with Kristen Hussey. The book is Imperial Bodies in London, Empire Mobility and the Making of British Medicine, 1880 to 1914. I do want you to speak to two historians that you quoted here, Antoinette Burton and Tony Ballantyne. And they talked about the kinetic model of imperial space. And when I read that, I went, oh my, this is true. This is so true of the empire, because it's in flux. It's constantly moving. It's this energy. And what you did is to take this spatial theory that's out there and merge it with the history of medicine. And I wondered if you feel like you succeeded.
It's hard to say. I mean, especially when you compare it to people like Burton and Ballantyne, was like people who I admire so much. And I think that their work on the kinetic model is a really important contribution. And I can't say that there's any, I haven't developed any of my own theories of connectedness in the book. But for me, I think what I hope that I've done is taken some of the theoretical contributions of geographers, especially people like Alan Lester, and just shown how they can be used in the context of the history of medicine. Because I think it would be fair to say, now I'm going to get in trouble, but I think it would be fair to say that historians of medicine are maybe not as open to theory, maybe, as other parts of history.
Right.
I mean, maybe take, for example, like the history of emotions and affect theory is really an area where we're getting really excited. But, you know, historians of empire use an awful lot of theory in their work. I think it's because the topic of empire is not one that you can approach without some kind of a tool, because it's so big and, as you say, moving and dynamic, that it just slips away from you every time you try and look at it. So these theoretical tools are absolutely essential for building those bridges to make it possible to say anything meaningful. And I mean, whether people get a sense of a world on the move in the book, I hope so. It was always a tension writing it, because it's a book of stories. It's a book of people's stories and particular moments, and kind of a micro history a bit. And it knows an approach that you work with also. So you're freezing things in the moment to show how they're mobile. And that's a very kind of contradictory approach.
Yeah, I think you pulled it off, by the way. I think you did very well. Yeah. One of the things that shocked me was, in the book, very early on and throughout the book, is London is looked at as, at this period of time, to show you the dynamics of this kinetic movement, of this spatial theory. I'm an 18th century guy, so people always left London because it was just this place that was horrid. And, you know, if you wanted to recover, you went to Bath in West England, right? But now I'm reading London is a health resort for people who are, you know, throughout the empire. Go back to London, you'll get healthy. And I'm like, what? Really? Yeah.
I think it's it was a part of the research that I was also really surprised by, which is why a lot of that goes in there. You know, is it healthy or unhealthy to be in London? And for the most part in history, you know, we read about London as being a cold and sickly and terrible place, but it all kind of matters, you know, what angle you're looking at it from. But I think it speaks to some of the dynamics of empire and imperialism, in that, you know, for something like the empire to make sense, it has to have this sort of immense, amazing, cosmopolitan, wealthy, fantastic center to it. You know, that's the home of civilization. So it's a difficult role for a city like London to play, which is, you know, dirty and busy and disease ridden. And, you know, how can you be both the sort of shining sentinel of empire and also that kind of experience? And it's these sort of conceptual knots that you get into when you try and think about an empire. That's in a lot of it's a lot of double talk.
Because I mean, London at this time, you have the West End, but then you have the East End, and then they're like two totally different planets. I mean, that's the best way I could put it. But yeah, it just struck me as kind of funny.
Yeah, and I think that contrast of West and East is definitely there in the book as well, because the experiences, you know, of talking about a Lascar sailor living in London's East End and, you know, someone who's just moved home from India and is settled in Kensington, they're living in the same city, but their experiences are completely opposite.
So I also enjoyed, as you just mentioned, the scattering of stories here. And readers would be very familiar with Mr. Rudyard Kipling. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have the book in front of you. Mm-hmm. And on page 31, there's this brilliant introduction with Mr. Kipling.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could read that for us.
Yeah. Oh, I love this quote so much. Okay. But in all this jam of work done or devising, demands, distractions, excitements, and promiscuous confusions, my health cracked again. I had broken down twice in India from straight overwork, plus fever and dysentery, but this time the staleness and depression came after a bout of real influenza, when all my Indian microbes joined hands and sang for a month in the darkness of Villiers Street.
I mean, poor Rudyard, but
yeah.
at least he's having a... I don't know. He's staying true to who he is.
Yeah, but this sense of carrying with you, you know, of having something living inside you, some part of your Indian experience that you're never got rid of, and especially one that's set off by, as you say, the kind of dark, damp, dirty nature of London, which is, you know, almost a hazard in itself as much as having a dysentery bug. It speaks to so much of many experiences of people like Kipling, Anglo-Indians with a similar kind of experience. It just captures it so well, I think.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about the liver. And how did physicians come to focus on that particular body part?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the answer to that could be really long. As you probably know, we could go back to Galen talking about the liver is the center of health because it's, you know, the largest organ in the body and therefore must be commensurately important. But I think in the 18th century, the liver becomes a hot topic of health, and the idea that, you know, unless your digestion is correct, you can't possibly be well. And it becomes even, there are a number of historians that argue it becomes very fashionable to have a liver disease. To be bilious means that you, live a luxurious life, or you're someone who has the time to eat and think. So by the time we get into the 19th century, the liver still kind of holds this important place in medical thinking, but also in cultural thinking. And then it's really people like James Johnson, the surgeon James Johnson, who found a theory for why it is that the liver is so central to the experience of people who've been in heat. And he's trying to make what perhaps in the past was more associative, he's trying to find the mechanism, the anatomical mechanism to explain why your liver is out of sorts if you've been living in India. Even though there's someone in the book who argues that it could be that there's some kind of intergenerational tendency to have liver problems, that the British have been in India so long that we're now inheriting disturbed livers, which I think is a really fun idea.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
It fascinates me because I've been to India and traveled throughout the tropics, and diet has always been immensely important. And I go there and thinking, well, I'm in Rome, let's do what the Romans do. If I'm in India, I'm going to eat the finest Indian food. I never got sick. I'm just curious how someone took the heat and the sun that hits you on the skin and you sweat, and then somehow that's the focus of the liver. It kind of threw me for a little bit.
Yeah. The idea of this sort of, again, the skin, how the skin and the liver interact with each other, that somehow through sweating or not sweating, it was inhibiting your liver's production of bile, and that if you sweat too much, then you'll you'll stop being able to sweat, and then your liver will become really stagnant. The only thing you can do is take baths and kind of rub yourself briskly. And it does sort of make sense if you think about a body that's unaccustomed to heat. You know, what's one of the main things that's happening? You're sweating a lot. So you start to think, well, what kinds of effects could this have on the body? But I think that in the past, ideas of health are so tied up with the gut, maybe more than we realize. You know, I think today we're quite like brain-centered people. And I think in the past, the gut was just so central to people's understandings of balance and how their body stayed in balance.
I think that's true. I think there was such a hand-to-mouth existence. and I think that carried through from the 18th to the 19th, maybe even into the 20th century. I'm talking with Kristen Hussey. You're listening to the New Books Network. We're looking at Imperial Bodies in London. And one of the other things that fascinated me is this word that I used often and you use as well, reciprocity. It's not just from the Empire back to London, but it's also London to the Empire and the back and forth that goes on. In this period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Douglas Haynes who describes it as an imperial medical culture. That it's almost, you know, pointless, you know, to have arguments about, is it one way or is it the other way? It's that it's all the same thing. It's all a kind of constant conversation, negotiation, remaking that's happening. And I guess what I was interested in doing here is just trying to tease out some of those remakings and trying to understand some of the mechanisms that was mediating, what is brought in, what's allowed out, what becomes sort of standard practice and what doesn't. I think it's fair to say at the end of the 19th century, it's maybe not the kind of, you know, fluid exchange of ideas that was perhaps more the case early on. A lot of people who have done really great work around medical plants and the pharmacopoeia and showing, you know, how Indian medicine was incorporated into the British pharmacopoeia in this sort of more fluid 18th century period. And I think in the 19th century, this remaking, this connection is still happening. It just takes a different form and is mediated by different forces. So that was what I was hoping to find a way of kind of grasping onto materially.
I mean, how else do we get quinine, right? I mean,
yeah.
If it's not for the Empire. I was looking at one point where there's a quote, I think it was Edward Waring or maybe James Renald Martin, but they were keenly aware of emotional and mental toll of people reintegrating back into British society. You have someone who might be working for the East Indies Company or the India office, or they're stationed in Mumbai, spend a few years, and then they come back. But it's that mental and emotional toll. Mm. I wish you could speak to that.
Yeah, I think it's a big part of the book. Quite a lot of the sort of the first half of the book really deals with the experiences of people I call tropical returners or ex-colonials. And sort of the costs of empire, in a sense, what it takes to be a part of that imperial machine, which are very different depending on, class is an important element because there are stories in the books of very working class soldiers who are drafted into the army because they have no other choice, and then are sent abroad, and perhaps they become ill, or it's just really challenging for them to be away from their families, and then they end up back in London with absolutely no support or training whatsoever. So it's often little surprise we find them, dragged in front of a court for stealing because they're starving or they've become addicted to alcohol and therefore they're in the asylum. And the stories are just really harrowing, I think, which isn't to take away, of course, from the fact that the burdens of the empire were definitely borne by colonized people. But at the same time, I think it's also interesting to think about how imperialism and the practice of imperialism was harmful for many different kinds of people who were involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to shift gears once again here. And there's an archive in London that's just absolutely wonderful. And I know you spent a lot of time in it, called the Welcome Library. Talk to us about it. It is an amazing place.
It is. I can only hope. I really hope that they're going to buy this book. If you're listening, librarians of the Welcome Library, please buy my book, because it is my career aspiration to see a book, you know, my book sitting on their new acquisitions shelf. Because it's really a home for historians of medicine around the world, both in terms of the secondary resources you can get there, but also really amazing primary source collections. So one thing that I came across in my work there that I was so excited by was this resource I talk about in the fourth chapter of the book, which is about Patrick Manson. And I was trying to find out more about the patients at the Albert Dock Hospital, and to have a look at some of those patient records, you know, classic historian of medicine source. But the early Albert Dock Hospital records don't exist anymore. And there are some, I mean, I can say within the historical community, there are some rumors about why that is that I won't repeat here, but there it's slightly salacious. But I was really struggling to find any kind of records of patients there. And then in the Welcome Archives, I pulled up, it's a scrapbook of George Carmichael Lowe, who was a parasitologist who worked there for a while. And I didn't, I mean, I was just looking at it because I knew the name. And then at the front of this book, like almost like jotted kind of on the cover, were these lists of patients and patient names and times and dates of people at the hospital who were part of a study on blood worms, on filariasis. And it's a very incomplete record. But I use it to make some statements about the kinds of patients who were part of the research that they did there, and what role that race played. But it just goes to show, like, you just never know what you're going to find in the archive.
I know from my experience, not only what you just described, finding things that just fit and like, oh my, this is really going to help me. But also the people that are archivists and that help you out. Did you find that at Welcome Library?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And there are people, librarians there that I've known, a couple people who I've known for quite a while. Also because, I mean, I think I'm immensely privileged to have been for a time a part of that world of curators and librarians and archivists who work so hard to preserve and share the history of medicine in London and in the UK. And it's quite a tight-knit group of people who try and support each other, because it's, I mean, like so much of the practice of history in the United Kingdom at the moment is really coming under fire in terms of resources, in terms of staffing. And it's just absolutely irreplaceable knowledge that these people are working hard to save. It's a really amazing group.
Yeah. Thank you for talking to us about that, because archivists play such a vital role in what historians do. And I never really get a chance to talk about it here on the New Books Network or with other people. But in this case, I think it's warranted to talk about how amazing the staff is at the Welcome Library.
Yeah. And also, and I will also say, at the London School of Tropical Medicine, I spent an enormous amount of time in their archive.
Yes, yes.
And what generous people. I hadn't even realized going in that they hold also an object, like material culture collection. And one of the days I was there, I was researching Patrick Manson, and I had a lot of Manson archives out. And one of them said, oh, did you know that we have his trocar? So Patrick Manson invented a sort of a liver, a surgical tool for puncturing and draining abscesses of the liver. You know, speaking about the liver as a sort of tropical organ, it was a main tropical disease that people suffered. You'd probably get a parasite in the liver and it would make an abscess. And they were like, hold on. And went upstairs and just came back and you know, gave me like, look at this. It's such a joy to share that, you know, excitement with an archivist.
It absolutely is. Thank you for talking about it. I'm talking with Kristen Hussey. She's wrote a fantastic book, Imperial Bodies in London, Empire Mobility and the Making of British Medicine. And just a quick question about that. 1880 to 1920, the leader in medical research, would you consider it to be London?
What, globally?
Globally, yes, absolutely.
Well, now in this moment that you've asked me the question, I worry that I've done that thing that all historians worry about, where I've just become too immersed in my sources and I'm not thinking about them critically enough. You know, that I'm, oh yeah, I've just accepted that London is sort of leading the world. I still think that's fair. I think it's fair to say that London is the center of medical knowledge globally in this period, although undoubtedly rivaled by the French. I think it has to be said that a lot of the part of the reason why there's so much like energy and passion is going into British medicine in the late 19th century is because they're trying to keep up with the French and the Germans, especially in the realm of tropical medicine, where the French, you know, Charles Laveran are making really important discoveries. So when Manson's writing to Ronald Ross, he says often, you know, we have to claim it for England, for Britain. So there's such a strong sense of nationalism in what they do, and a really purposeful sense that London is and must remain the center of medicine, but that it needs to be made to be so. It needs to be maintained in that way. And then there's also, you know, the fact that London guards its privileges jealously. So, you know, the fact that you couldn't become, you know, you couldn't qualify as a physician or a surgeon in India, which is, you know, insane that you'd have to get to London in order to take the exams to call yourself a doctor. It's a very purposeful focusing of that power in the city.
I just got this image of Manson with a needle. So I'm going to plunge into your liver and drain your abscess for England.
For England. So funny as well, because he's Scottish, really writes about, I mean, well, that's like a whole other story about the relationship of the nations within the United Kingdom. But yeah, this right. love the rhetoric is a lot around England. And yeah.
Absolutely. Another shift here, it's the insurance that's behind all of this, the Standard Life Company, you point out, and how do we put an insurance fee on those people who are traveling to the tropics? And at first, the fees are really super high, but then comes the medicine, and I want you to describe what happens after that.
The insurance question and the work of actuaries is such a fascinating one that I wouldn't have really thought about before working on this topic. Because I think the practice of insuring one's life or one's home is a relatively recent one in the 19th century. And I think it's just so commonly known that in all likelihoods, if someone is shipping out to India, that they may not come back. The idea that you ought to put something aside for your family in that case really fuels the insurance industry. So that when, you know, by in the early part of the 19th century, the fees are very high. So the kinds of people who are insuring their lives, they call them first class lives, which is strange on so many levels, you know, yes. The kinds of people that could really afford to look after their family. But then I think as the empire becomes more and more mobile, it's sort of a supply and demand question. You know, if you have so many potential customers, you know, would you really turn them down by keeping the rates so high? So it's this weird negotiation between kind of capitalism and wanting to profit the most possible from the industry, and then the role of medicine in sort of negotiating or facilitating this very capitalistic idea that a life has a numerical value. And I'm really fascinated by the role that these physicians play, in mediating between the industry of the actuarial industry and their patients. I hadn't realized before working on the book how many doctors and surgeons supplemented their income working for insurance companies, assessing whether or not people were well or not well. Even people like Benson were essentially performing that role working for the Colonial Office. So there's always this like undercurrent of money, of the finance in the medical world.
You always got to follow the money, as I say. And it was a surprise to me as well. I didn't expect that a doctor of medicine would insert themselves into the insurance industry, and yet there it was.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah, but I think it's there's so many to be a physician or a surgeon in this period is so competitive. And people like Douglas Haynes have argued that that's sort of an important role that the empire was playing, was providing jobs for the many people who were training to be physicians and surgeons and giving them, a career opportunity. So if you couldn't get a job at a London hospital and maybe you couldn't get on a ship to go abroad, you could also work for an insurance company or a friendly society or things like that. So yeah, the economic history of medicine is fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating. One part in your book, I'm going to switch over to the brain now. And again, here's the sun, here's the tropical heat beating down upon these British bodies. And then there's some people who claim, I think it was James Martin, who looked at this and saying, well, Europeans are just going to droop and degenerate, both physically and mentally. There's no doubt about it. And then you also quoted some medical folks in the American Philippines that are kind of noticing the same thing. And if let's talk about that.
Yeah. I think it's a ubiquitous problem of Europeans in tropical climates, that the physical discomfort that comes with being in a heat that you're not accustomed to. To be fair, I think people who grow up in hot climates also find it very uncomfortable to be in the heat, but especially if you're not used to it. And it's the question of how to live and stay well in hot climates is an interesting one, because on the one hand, complaining about the heat and the idea that being in the heat sort of physically and mentally and morally degrades you is also kind of a backhanded way of saying something about the people who live there. Sort of implies that you couldn't be intelligent and civilized and sharp if you'd grown up in those climates.
Right,
so
right.
It's a sort of negotiation of bodies that says, it's partially the reason why, Europeans go insane in the tropics is because our brains are so superior. We're not made for living in these sort of dark, uncivilized lands. But on the other hand, there are genuinely physiological effects that happen from being exposed to extreme heat. So heat stroke is a very real problem for British soldiers in India. I think today, increasingly with discussions of climate change, I think we're becoming really concerned about heat stroke and other heat-related disorders. So thinking about the idea of the tropical sun is this weird mashup of very cultural values and judgments that are being made and a very definite physiological issue.
Yeah, I think we had a massive heat wave here in North America that hit British Columbia. Temperatures there got into 120 degrees. I think there were over 400 deaths related to that one cyclonic heat wave.
Oh, yeah.
There was something that shouldn't have happened. I don't know if you heard that.
I did not. I think this discussion about heat is an important one. But in the book, I do talk about how the heat is being blamed for a lot of mental illness, which is probably not the result of the heat itself, and the way that physicians justify the fact that it's being caused by the climate. It's, to me, is fascinating that people like Joseph Fayer, who were Indian surgeons who've worked in India, very convinced by the argument that a European brain will degenerate in the tropical sun, and then when patients who've been stamped as sunstroke insane come back to London, other doctors working in Britain are like, no, this is not that's not a real thing. You're showing me a patient here who has very severe alcohol addiction, they suffer from delirium tremens, and they probably have syphilis. I'm gonna say it's probably one of those things and not the tropical sun. But it's it's what's the place of this sort of cultural imagining in medicine?
But this place publicly too, which gets us to the McNaughton rules and the idea that in a trial you can plead insanity. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I was really fascinated to find you know, it's a book about imperial bodies. So in all of the chapters that you can see me, I'm looking for the stories of imperial people in different domestic forums. And if you Google, you know, not Google, sorry, but if you're working, say, in a newspaper archive, in the British newspaper archive, and you're looking up India soldier, you're going to get court records of criminal cases involving people who've lived in India for some time. And in many, many cases, they are suicide cases. That was probably the commonest sort of combination of words that would come up, would be sort of India soldier suicide. And they were very, suicide cases and other criminal cases are very widely reported in the print media, as we were talking about before, partially as entertainment and partially as news. But what I became really interested by was the fact that while physicians, British physicians, weren't necessarily convinced that, you know, it was fair to say that if you had sunstroke in India 20 years ago, that's why you might end up being suicidal. It was an idea that had a lot of cultural capital, and it was an idea that that, you know, judges could grab onto and juries could grab onto and families could grab onto and say, you know, it's such a hard, you know, toll being in India that it must explain why these people had such sad lives. So I argue in the book that it becomes this sort of escape route of explaining, you know, mental illness or explaining potential criminal behavior as saying that in terms of sacrifice, you know, the reason why this has happened is they sacrifice their brains, their bodies, and their mental well-being in the service of empire. So the idea that the sun has these long-term and insidious effects serve a really important purpose for people, for families especially, rather than thinking about suicide, which was at the time a criminal act.
Yeah. I want to talk about the East Indies Company. I know they're big. The thing that surprised me the most is that they had their own surgeons. Yeah, okay, I can see that. And then they had their own asylums. I was just plastered by this. And so I guess I want to talk about the asylum end of things for how big an industry is the asylum industry at the late 19th, early 20th century?
Well, I think by the early 20th century, things are winding down a little bit. But throughout the 19th century, people talk about the great confinement, the idea that somehow previously there hadn't been that much mental illness, and then out of nowhere you get this, I mean, what's genuinely like a big business of asylums. And what the East India Company does is they found a private asylum. So this is very, very common, where you have basically one or two physicians or alienists who rent a house, and they kind of live in with their patients. So it's not quite an institution in the way we think about now. It's like a sort of domestic environment in which people are cared for. And so this is an arrangement that the East India Company comes up with to deal with employees or even families of employees who suffer from mental illness, whether while they're abroad in service or later on in their lives, because you're always like kind of, once you're an India office employee, you always are sort of their responsibility in a sense. And then the asylum becomes a bit overpopulated and it becomes a very expensive arrangement. And then eventually in the 1870s, they found a much more formal hospital style asylum in Ealing, which is just outside London, where they move. And then they have a lot of their patients are very old ex East India Company people from well after a time where the East Indian Company no longer functions, you know, because, you know, people who were working in 1820 or 1830, and many of them are still alive in the end of the 19th century, right. Even though time has moved on. And they do get less and less patients as the 20th century nears, and eventually the asylum closes down. Anyone that's left is sent really to military naval asylums.
Yeah. And this is a good segue for me to ask, not to ask, but to point out, one of the things I'm fascinated by is the competition and the need for imperial bodies. And there's a scene in your book, Dr. Patrick Manson on Queen Anne Street. Hey, son, come in here. I'm going to want you to get stung by these malarial-ridden mosquitoes.
Yeah, I told this story at an event recently, and someone asked me afterwards, oh my God, did he die? I just want to be clear that Patrick Manson did not kill his own son by infecting him with malaria. There's definitely, as you say, there's such a competition amongst medical practitioners in the late 19th century to get their hands on people who've lived in the empire in some senses, but especially, non-white, basically black and brown people, bodies that are perceived as very exotic. It's very illustrious for a physician to be able to work on someone like that, because then they can show them at the clinical society and who knows what kind of exciting things you might find. But if you didn't have a patient like that to work with, yet you could try and make your own, like Manson does by doing a trial with malarial mosquitoes where his son is bitten. And this was a consensual trial, I will say, because at this time, Patrick Manson's son, who's also called Patrick, but goes by Bernie, I think, he's a medical student. And then, so he volunteers for this trial where they try and get mosquitoes to bite him and see if he catches malaria. And actually, it's a crucial experiment at the time, because so many people still believed that malaria was being caused by environmental factors, by miasmas and bad airs. But if Manson could show that a person who'd not been abroad, who had been in London this whole time, could get it from a mosquito, then it was going to be, he believed, definitive proof that this is how it was passing. And then actually his son wrote a little note about his personal experience of it and published it in the British Medical Journal. So it was a real family affair.
I'm wondering if young Patrick took out an insurance policy before this thing happened. That is fascinating, actually. And it just shows the competition for, I need someone to do this and to show the pathogens in the blood.
Yeah. And he tells in his diary that he was so, excited and invested in the outcome of this, because he was very passionate about demonstrating that malaria was caused by mosquitoes, that at a certain point he felt he just had to remove himself, like lest he somehow be seen as like interfering with the experiment, because he really wanted it to be taken very, very seriously in the medical community, even though it was in his house with his son.
Yes, absolutely. I'm talking with Kristen Hussey, and her book is Imperial Bodies in London. And I want to talk about William James Haddon. He's of mixed race. And of course, we're talking about the empire, late 19th, early 20th century. So racism is definitely going to pop up. Can you speak to what happened to Haddon?
Yeah, so race, as you say, is a really important part of the book. And I hope that I take a very critical approach to race, showing both the ways that race is constructed, the way that whiteness is constructed and negotiated, and the way that race and the racialization of bodies is a part of how disease is perceived and treated. And I think that Haddon's story is a really good example of that. And it's interesting to talk about, because William Haddon is probably not someone anyone's ever written about in a history book before. He's a person whose story I came upon working in an asylum archive. And it's difficult to trace the stories of non-white people, of people of mixed ethnicity in the archives, because that there's no, you might tick whether someone's male or female, but there's no category for race typically. But we do find, because racism is such an important part in the way that people perceive others, that asylum attendants will find some way to let you know that the patient is not white. And there's often a lot of judgments that come with that. So for example, in Haddon's case record, they say, what class of patient is this? And that usually refers to how wealthy or how educated they are. I think for Haddon, they say he's a third class patient, which is insane, because William Haddon is a practicing physician who went to a prestigious university and comes from a physician family. So you just see the way that class and race are sort of intersected. And without getting too much into you know, the personal story of William Haddon. He's someone who comes from a mixed family, whose great, I think his grandfather was Scottish and came to India. And then, you know, they had a family there and he's descended from this family, and he and his brothers are very successful. They travel back to England and they train as physicians in Edinburgh. His brother is also a physician. And then they work in India. Then he works in the United Kingdom and marries an English lady and has children. But he struggles with mental illness throughout his life, both in India and in the UK. And the reasons for this are always a bit up into interpretation. And what I'm arguing in the book is that here is a case that you would totally expect to say, this is sunstroke insanity. This is someone who's gone mad because they lived in India. That's what the diagnosis would have been if this was a white person. But because it's not a white person, they make the argument that the insanity is coming from syphilis and that it's something to do with sexual deviancy. So it's, of course, a very sad case. It could well be someone who eventually dies of the complications of syphilis. I don't know. We can only look at what the asylum attendants are writing. But what I'm trying to show is the way that, yeah, the bodies are racialized and the way that sort of mental health diagnoses change based on how the physicians perceive the person.
And that's a good segue to the diversity of the empire. I have to kind of close this out here, and I think your book is so super timely because well, we're in the midst of our own global pandemic right now, and it has proven to be a rather diverse, ever-morphing virus and attacking so many different people from around the world. And then I'm looking at your book, which was Imperial, I just can't not help make the parallels between, I guess, congratulations, you wrote a book published during the pandemic. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I mean, I think when I was thinking about my book in terms of the pandemic, I thought to myself, oh, no, I really should have written a book about infectious disease, because really I've written a book about chronic illnesses and kind of mental health issues and malaria and things that come back over and over again. But at the same time, I think we've dealt with epidemics so much sort of throughout human history. And sometimes in those epidemics, which are very sad and of course very important, we can overlook a lot of the day-to-day health issues. And I know that's also been an issue with coronavirus, people who can't get the cancer help they need, people who can't manage chronic conditions they have. So I hope that it's also sort of a plea to think about, to keep a bigger picture.
So Kristen, what are you going to be working on next?
Oh, my current project, actually, I'm currently a postdoc at the University of Copenhagen, and I'm doing work which is a little bit different about the rhythmic body and the idea that our bodies live in a rhythm and cycles, and how the idea of time and timing influences health and disease in the late 19th century. So again, a lot of interest in speed, interest in technology, in electricity, and how sleeping and eating and these day-to-day rhythms are affected by modernity.
Magnificent. I've been talking with Kristen Hussey. Fantastic book, Imperial Bodies in London, Empire Mobility and the Making of British Medicine, 1880 to 1914. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Joan, for some really insightful questions. I really enjoyed talking about that.